Well, let me formally welcome everybody. Is that all right with you, Nancy, that we go forward?
Yep. Go right ahead.
Again, Storytelling as Art and Process for Sexual Violence Prevention with Nancy Donoval, who is well known in the storytelling community and beyond. There are tellers who specialize in festivals and performance and some who specialize in workshops and conferences and keynotes, and Nancy does it all. And whenever I have heard her, I come away impressed over and over again with her humor, her intelligence, mm-hmm. and her integrity. So I think we're ready to listen now to Nancy Donoval. Again, star 6 to mute ourselves.
Okay.
And you have the floor for the next half an hour or so.
Okay. Great. Thanks. Great. And I would say if anybody does end up with, while I'm talking, with a question, I know you're all muted, but, you know, grab a piece of paper and write the question down so that you're not busy trying to remember it for later, because that can make it hard to keep listening. So just create a little parking area for questions you want to ask. Just as a quick overview, most of my work around sexual violence prevention is in the area of doing this on college campuses. And within that, I work performing my own show. I have a one-woman show. I use stories within educational programs and doing keynotes. And in the last few years, I've started getting involved in using digital storytelling and looking at art of hosting, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later on. So just to give you an idea of the scope when I'm talking about art and process. If you want to know more about the work that I'm doing, I know Joe had my homepage website there, but the specific page that's around this work is storiestostoprape.com, and that's with the number 2, storiestostoprape.com, and that's got some commentaries that I've written, and a couple of which have actually made it to the on-air from Minnesota Public Radio, and some sample stories, and one of the digital stories I'll talk about is available there, too. So if you want to get a little bit more sense of what I do, that's there as well. Because there's only really so much we can do in half an hour, so I'm going to try to do the streamlined version here. I have been... Well, if I really think about it, I've been a storyteller since I was about 7, or possibly in the womb. But at 7, that's when I decided I wanted to go into theater, and it wasn't until I was in graduate school getting my MFA in directing that I was introduced to storytelling as an art form. So in many ways, trying to find a way to do activism around sexual violence predates my being a storyteller. For anyone who hasn't seen this and the stuff that I do, I'm a survivor of sexual assault from when I was a freshman in college. And when my assailant finally graduated, because we were in the same theater department together, so afterwards I was still in school with him for about a year and a half, once he graduated, I actually tried to start a rape awareness program on campus. I knew nothing about what I was doing, and this was back in 1981, and we didn't even have language for this. We didn't really have the language date rape. We didn't have the language acquaintance rape. There were very few things out there in terms of, crisis centers or support for this, and so really it was trying to create something in a vacuum. And it wasn't particularly successful, and I kind of went, okay, I tried, and started putting that away. And then the first time I ever told, publicly anything to any group about what happened to me was as part of a retreat program that I was involved with. I was strongly involved with the Teens Encounter Christ retreat program, and within their structure, you do witness talks, and one of them was dying in Christ, and you were supposed to talk about a particularly difficult or hard time in your life. This is so long ago now, I think, I don't know what I said in that 15-minute talk. I have no memory at all of how I structured it. Like I said, long before I heard of storytelling, that was the first time that I, spoke to people other than just, you know, friends or a therapist. And that also was my first experience of once I tell my story, I start to have people telling me theirs. At 2 o'clock in the morning at the retreat, there was a knock at my door, and one of the high school students in the retreat was at my door to talk to me about something that happened to her as a child and that she was afraid was going to happen to her little sister, and I had no preparation of any kind for what I was going to do with that. And that was also my first experience of trying to work within systems that were not ready and not particularly willing to deal with this issue. Because I remember going to the people in charge of our local part of the retreat program, and they were all people I'd known for years and really cared about, admired very much, and saying, okay, I have this person disclosing to me. I don't really know what it is that I should do. What are our policies on this? And essentially being told, you know, we're here to pray for her soul, and this is not, you know, this is not our issue, which, just was not acceptable to me. So I spent a lot of time, you know, finding people who could talk about this and finding ways of doing policies for this and really fighting an uphill battle around it. And I got very discouraged because there just seemed to be no interest in the idea that we had any responsibility around this. And then when I was in graduate school, one of the classes that I took was a performance studies class, and we were given different assignments for doing, not performance studies, performance art. So it was, you know, yeah, you're doing performance, but, you know, are you also going to shave during it? One of my favorite jokes is, what do you get when you cross a mobster with a performance artist, someone who makes you an offer you can't understand? So it was a whole lot of 20-something theater folks getting to explore doing opaque performance. But one of our assignments, we had speak the dream and speak the memory, and one of our assignments was speak politically. And for speak politically, I did a 20-minute piece about rape. And so this is something that has really, that the drive to do something about this, do something with this, do something to cause some kind of change and to use art to do it has been with me for quite a long time. I graduated from grad school in 1988, and at that point I really wasn't planning on telling autobiographical stories. I was a little afraid of them. I had seen really good ones that I didn't know how to do, and I'd seen really bad ones that I was sure I would do, and I really thought of myself as a little Miss Folktale. But a few years in, I started being pulled into the realm of autobiographical story. Again, it's funny to me looking back because now that's so much the center of my work. And once I started doing autobiography, I really was pulled to telling stories about the things that we don't really talk about, finding ways to use humor in talking about loss of loved ones and talking about body image and talking about disability and talking about all these different things. And I knew that at some point I wanted to be able to do a story about being raped in college, but I didn't really know how to do it without it being therapy on stage, which I was not interested in doing. And I kept kind of coming up to it and going away from it and coming up to it. And when people would do workshops, you'll never be able to tell. This was usually the one that I would pull out. And as I became more experienced as a storyteller, and even as I started teaching storytelling more and more, I started understanding a lot more about the notion of finding universals and finding ways for people to get into the story. And I'd say about 15 years after I first had the idea that I wanted to tell that story as a show, I found my way in, or at least my way in for the first version. And a lot for that for me was finding the better question, that just saying, oh, I want to do this as a show, how do I do that? When I'm looking for the answer, I often can't find it, but when I formulate a better question, that often helps me. And so I ended up with the question of, what is this story about, that is bigger than the actual event or the umbrella that it fits in, so that people who've not been through that same experience could still have something in their life that it would be equivalent to, that this is an example of. And I finally found my way to the notion of what-ifing and the moments in our lives that we try to wish away, the stories that, what's the story in your life that tries to eat up all the rest of the stories? And a lot of it was about getting trapped in the what-ifs. And partly it was just having an opportunity. I had lived most of my life in Chicago. I'd ended up moving to Minneapolis, and in Minneapolis we have a fringe festival, which is wonderful. You join a lottery. If your little ping pong ball gets drawn, you have a slot. I actually have to say, when I did this back then, it was just if you applied soon enough, you would get in. Now we're at the lottery place. But I had the struggle of, and once I do this story, who will want to hear it, and where would I get to do it? And oddly enough, most of my storytelling seems to be for children or in schools, or that's where people book it. It's the ghost story performances. So who really wants to hear this story, or where could I tell it? And so having the Fringe, where I actually had a place where I had an hour where I could really do whatever I want, was a wonderful opportunity. And so I first did my show under the title Attack of the Killer What Ifs back in 2002. And it wasn't geared towards college students at all. It was geared towards sort of a mainstream fringe festival audience. I will say that working on that story taught me a huge amount about storytelling. I think the issues that I've dealt with in doing this story have actually made me be a lot more aware and mindful for a lot of other stories that I do. But once I did it, I actually kind of let it sit. So, you know, just getting to actually being able to do it, and it's art, and I'm not crying in front of people, and yay. But I was also collecting more and more Me Toos, that as just doing 5 shows as part of the Fringe, afterwards in the lobby, I would just have people come up to me and lean into my ear and whisper Me Too and maybe say the age they were or what they were wearing or the name or the relationship of the person who had harmed them. Most of them were people I did not know, but it was also some people that I did know that I didn't know this about. And I would say those Me Toos really became, in many ways, the heartbeat that was pushing me to do more with this. But I wasn't quite sure what that meant. And I let the story lie fallow for a little bit. I told it as part of a laughing in the dark, using humor to turn private pain into public art intensive at the National Storytelling Conference in 2003, which I really wish I'd recorded, because boy, oh boy, aren't storytellers the best audience in the world. It's the group that actually got the humor the best. Any group I've ever told the story to, they were the least afraid to laugh. So that was really quite fun to tell it to them. And to discover that story could be fun was, for me, a very interesting discovery. But it still ended up sitting on the back burner while I was trying to figure out what I would really do with it. And then I ended up being invited to be part of a festival that was around interfaith, spirituality, and social justice performance in 2008. And so I brought it back out and reframed it, changed the name. I think at that point it was called Date Rape for Beginners. Did it a couple more times. And within doing that, just from the postcard of that, I actually had a college contact me. So it was one of those things of, anybody thinks I had this grand plan of like, oh, yes, I had this vague idea. Yes, I want to take this to colleges, but I'm not really sure if I'm ready. And then an opportunity came, and I needed to be ready. So I ended up taking it to my first college campus. It was very interesting to me to discover how problematic talking about it on campuses was. There ended up being huge struggles around what the title was, I had to change the title several times. They didn't like the subtitle, which was A Seriously Funny Tale of Trauma and Recovery. How could I even talk about humor in terms of this? So it's really interesting for me in terms of dealing with a very hot-button topic, how carefully it needs to be framed in terms of actually getting it out there, that you can get so much resistance just in the first moments. And I really had to make choices around, do I want to hold to my artistic integrity, or do I actually want to get on campuses and do this work? And I actually found a way to do both, but I certainly had to let go of a lot of my ideas about titling. At that point in 2010, I started taking it to colleges. And I really ended up having to change the show because that's a very particular audience. And when I'd first written it, I was in my early 40s, and a lot of it had to do about being in my early 40s and how the impact of this had played out in my life. And doing it on college campus for 18, 19, 20-year-olds, that is not a perspective that was useful to them. And what they really needed was a whole lot more stuff about what it was like for me when I was in college, what it was like to still be in the same department with him, what it was like that they really needed me to spend way more time in my college years. So one of the things I've learned very much is how adaptable I need this show to be and what a good benefit that is, what a great benefit storytelling is, the notion that it isn't fixed, that I can change it for what this audience on this day needs. I now, before I go to any school or any community, I have a questionnaire that I send out that asks a ton of stuff. I interview 5 to 10. If I get more names, I talk to more people, staff, faculty, community people. I always ask to talk to students, and please male and female students, if you can find them for me, to find out what's really going on in that community. And then I will put pieces into the show or take pieces out, depending on what it is, or lengthen pieces and shorten sections, depending on what they're talking about is actually happening on that campus. So if that campus is really struggling with, there's a ton of stigma around going to counseling, we can't get anybody to go to counseling, then what it took for me to finally see a professional and what the benefits of that were in story, not in lecture, really gets heightened. I was just at a campus a month ago where everybody I talked to me about victim blaming and what a huge victim blaming culture there was on that campus. So something else left the show so that could come in. As we all know, as storytellers, you end up leaving out more than you ever do. But that actual adaptability to what is needed right now has been really important for me. I'll say one of the things I really learned was that I couldn't just go on campus and tell my story, that I needed to learn the landscape, and not just the landscape of a campus, but I started going to conferences that are around sexual violence prevention, sexual violence in our schools. I go to quarterly sexual violence prevention network meetings here. And partly that started as marketing. But what it really is that if I'm trying to go out there and do activism about something, there are people who've been doing a tremendous amount of activism. Perhaps I should learn from them. So it's learning the landscape of the issue from something beyond just my perspective. And one of the things I've really struggled with is the tension between feeling like I need to become an expert in sexual violence rather to be able to do the thing that I'm doing well. And I still deal with that tension quite a bit. I'll tell you the biggest discovery that I had going out and doing this I don't know what I expected from any of this, but the farthest I had really thought towards was I want to be able to get out and do the show on campus because there's too much silence around this. And there's way too much shame. And I knew how much it would have meant to my 19-year-old self to know that she was not alone, to know that there were other people, to know that to just be walked through what this experience might be for somebody else. So my biggest goal was around modeling lack of shame and simply breaking silence. And it was funny because in the trying to model lack of shame, I was having to deconstruct and put down a lot of shame for myself. But beyond that, I hadn't really thought beyond that in terms of what I really wanted to do. And once I started really doing the show on campuses, I could see what the benefits were. I talked to a lot of survivors afterwards. I talked to a lot of secondary survivors afterwards. Soon as I even brought up the notion of secondary survivors, and even in readapting my show, I had to make sure that I was having compassion and modeling lack of shame, not just for survivors, but for people in their lives who did not respond well, because my audience was not just survivors, it was the whole community that did not know how to deal with this topic. So I had to have compassion for that while also being really honest about it. But I started discovering that really I was helping people in the aftermath, which was really important, but it wasn't really going to be very effective for prevention. And again, going to this camp, going to campuses, telling this story, I just keep collecting more and more and more and more stories of this. And for me, I look at what's changed since 1979 when this was done to me. And we have language now, and we have orientation programs about it, and, you know, we have, you know, it's more visible. But the statistics haven't changed at all in terms of the actual rate. And I always thought that the reason why I didn't know to call it what it was, it took me quite a long time to name it as what it was because we didn't actually have language like date rape or acquaintance rape or anything like that. So, but actually, that's the most common kind of question that I get asked by somebody. I do Q&As afterwards, and sometimes people will ask questions out loud, but I always allow for people sending me questions in writing, and those questions in writing are usually these 2- and 3-sentence little horror stories with people wanting me to tell them, does this count? Is this sexual assault? Is this rape? That is a huge aspect of people just not naming it as that. So on one level, the landscape's changed. On another level, it hasn't. And I have finally become dissatisfied with just going out and telling my story, that I know the place that it holds. I know it holds a valuable place. I want to keep doing it. But if I want to actually do prevention work, I have to move beyond that. And that was what in the last couple of years has really been pointing me towards digital storytelling and towards art of hosting practices. Digital storytelling, I got introduced to silentspeaks.org back when the Healing Story Alliance did their Healing Stories Conference here in Minneapolis. I met Amy Hill of Silent Speak, of the Center for Digital Storytelling, and started seeing what could be done with these little 3-4-minute stories from different survivors of violence, and I started really imagining what can I do to help other people tell these stories so that instead of just having my story out there and a few other stories out there, but what if we could get a groundswell of stories that this problem really became visible? So I started exploring digital storytelling around that. And then in the midst of doing that, and I actually have a digital story about this event on my website, I ended up going back to Marquette University, where I went to school, to keynote for their Sexual Violence Awareness Week in the fall a couple years ago. So it was where my assault happened. You know, the new student union was across the street from the bar where I was drinking that night. I went into the theater department, and there were all these pictures up on the wall, and there's a picture from one particular play, and he and I are both sitting there in that photo, and it was the fall after it happened. And so it was very much in the place where it was. But I ended up being contacted by the fraternity where it had happened. And they were really worried that I was coming to campus to name them and to destroy them on campus. And I ended up being invited to meet with the current members. And that ended up being a very powerful event for all of us, for them and for me. And I came out of that with this real desire, knowing how important story was to this, knowing how story really was my superpower for this, that it came at talking about it in the way of just doing plain, I'm a survivor, let me tell you the facts, that I could really shape something where they got to laugh at the beginning, they got to relax, they could see I was okay. I mean, I could see so much how important storytelling was. But that would only take me so far. That would open the conversation. And they were so hungry for, okay, we used to think that we're good guys, so this couldn't happen here. But now we're realizing we're good guys, so it's our job to make sure it doesn't happen here. How do we do that? And they had no interest in being connected with, like, the college health educator or any of the things that were already in place. And that's what started moving me into exploring art of hosting practices, and that's an umbrella term for a variety of different group processes like Open Space, World Cafe, Circle Practice, a number of different ones. But art of hosting looks at what are the dynamics that are going on within that and how do you use participatory leadership to have conversation and dialogue in communities that can move towards wise action and that can help communities figure out ways to solve complex problems from within the community as opposed to have a solution imposed from without. And that's really the problem on campuses, is that there's this tiny group of people that are trying to solve it with very few resources, and the lack of engagement by the community at large is enormous. And so for me, looking at Art of Hosting, which has a tremendous amount of narrative running through it, there's a whole lot of using personal experience and what our personal experiences are and tell about a time when, and that how you can harness the power of people's stories to connect them to the issue and then to start creating a new story for the community. What's the new story we want to have come from the inside? I'm really excited about the possibilities for that. And in fact, I went through a 3-day training in it last fall, which is tip of the iceberg. That's like saying, I went to a 3-day storytelling workshop and now I'm a storyteller. It's the same thing. I went through a 3-day workshop on that, and I know enough to know what I don't know. But I'm still, I'm working with some other people who are a lot more experienced, and as part of a Forgiveness 360 symposium that's going on right now, next weekend we've actually called a convening around the question of how can we create college campuses where healthy sexuality and consenting relationships are the norm. And we will be using people's stories within that. There's a lot of different ways that story functions in that. But I'm really hungry and really eager to get more into the trenches around prevention work while still valuing the work that I'm doing as art to hold up that lack of shame for survivors and their loved ones. Activism is a really tricky thing, and a lot of what's tricky about it is to get people to actually want to have it and want to look at things that are hard. And in the Healing Story Alliance, you know, it's a group that thrives on looking at things that are hard. But in the general public, that's kind of a tough sell. So on that level, story's been really useful to me to be able to come in and say, you know, I can bypass some of the resistance that you run into because storytelling really accesses empathy and accesses other issues for people. It gets into their hearts, and we're not just doing statistics. And the college health educators love that. And I can make it be a lot more accessible for people, but I cannot change this landscape on my own. It really is working in community with other people and actually do prevention work. And I'm excited to be able to use my storytelling background and bring that in and bring the skills from that into a community that is desperately trying to find a way to really change this. I think that's all I have to say. We'll see what people's questions are.
Thank you, Nancy. I think a lot of people came in while you were talking. So anybody who has a question or comment, feel free to unmute and jump in. And in the meantime, Nancy, we had talked about the intention to do the work and what you need to know you have on board in order to go forward with it, what pitfalls there might be, what risks you might be taking.
I think some things to think about are really making sure that you have your own support network in place if you are going to be telling a difficult story. I had to really be at the place before I could get onto campuses and really do this. I had to be at a place where telling this story was not costing me a lot emotionally. And that took quite a bit of time. But I needed to be there where I could really be present for the students. And that doesn't mean not letting emotion into the story or the vulnerability into the story, but where I wasn't working my own issues out on stage, that I would be, that after I was done with the story, I wouldn't need to go up, you know, go lick my wounds in a corner. I could really be present to listen to other people. I think.
I have a question.
Sorry, what?
No, I have a question. I'm sorry, you didn't finish what you were saying.
Well, I just, and I was not, I guess, I also finally realized how much it did take out of me to listen to everybody's stories, but that as soon as I got up and told my own, it really ended up becoming that people would imprint on me, and it wasn't just that, like, oh, I want to tell somebody, I want to talk to a counselor. People wanted to tell it to me because I was the one who had just modeled how to be able to talk about it. So I had to really work at, okay, what are our systems for that? I really started learning about having counselors available. I really started learning about in the Q&A session, I actually have somebody from wherever the counseling center is there on stage with me. So partly because there'll be questions asked that I can't answer that are like local things that I can't answer, but also that I'm literally trying to transfer some of that imprint of trust from me to the counselor. So it's just realizing what kind of, that you're unstopping a well and to be prepared for that. And I touched on this, but the other thing that I really started learning was that while I brought the survivor perspective, I had to be so aware in the story of the dynamics for other people involved in sexual violence, whether, you know, they were a boyfriend or a sibling or a parent, or, you know, when I was telling about my own brother having a terrible reaction or my mother having a terrible reaction, that I had to create a space in which I was not shaming people in the audience that had maybe at one time or another mm-hmm. been told something and had a bad reaction, because shame shuts all of us down, and if we're trying to deal with this in a better way. So it was really interesting to me to figure out, and I still figure that out, how to incorporate various perspectives into the story in a way that makes it safe, or as safe as I can make it, for all the people that are in the room. What's your question?
Hi. Well, I mean, I came in about 5 minutes late, so I'm not sure you didn't say this, but I was curious about how you begin the story, and do you only tell the story of the rape, or you go into the aftermath, or you use other narratives? What constitutes the performance?
Oh, well, it's, no, it's not just the event at all. If anything, that's the smallest part of it, because part of the whole point of it is the impact. One of the things that I find my task is when doing this is that I have to hold the paradox out there for the audience of the impact from this is enormous. It doesn't just go away. And I'm holding that for survivors to be able to mirror for them. Yeah, as bad as it feels, yeah, that it feels that bad.
How do you begin the piece? What is your first moment of it? How do you make that relationship and begin the story?
It's changed over time. I actually have a 5-minute slam piece on my website. that it's funny to me because the show itself is about 75 minutes and I need to get it down to 60, but it's about 75 minutes now. And when I created the 5-minute slam piece, it actually, now the beginning and the end of the show are actually the slam piece, and the whole rest of the show is like in the middle of, well, here's the beginning of the slam piece is the beginning of the show, and the end of the slam piece is the end of the show, and the whole rest of the show fits in the middle. But I actually start by talking about, I start in metaphor. I start talking about a bump that I have on my forehead and how frustrated I was with it, that it started growing. I wasn't born with it. It's every year it gets bigger, going to a doctor, trying to figure out, him telling me it's a bone spur. And that not being a good enough answer for me, and finally realizing that I was becoming a unicorn. And that making sense to me, because the only bait that ever worked, I'm truncating this, but the only bait that ever works with unicorns in medieval times was using virgins as bait, and then flipping it around to how long I'd wanted my virginity back. And my body maybe thinking that it would work in reverse, and that if I could turn into a unicorn, I could lure my virginity back. And then I actually tell a little story about a young man I knew in graduate school who gave my virginity back. So I actually have a story of a guy that's a very healing relationship,
mm-hmm.
and that starts me in to going back to this moment when I'm 19. But the structure of this story is never entirely sure whether to call it a spiral or more like a daisy almost. I keep coming up to the moment of the rape itself, but then hopping over it or hopping around it throughout the show, so that I don't actually get to the moment of that until almost the very end of the show. And I don't say the word rape for the first half of the show, though people, you know, pretty clear what I'm talking about, but I don't say that word until in the story the 20-year-old version of me is given the word, because I didn't have it when I was 19. And when I was 20, I was describing what happened to me to somebody, and they told me the word. And so I don't name it until I got it. So I do a lot of coming up to the hard stuff and then going to something else, coming up to the hard stuff and going to something else. And a big frame of it is, once you have the word, who do you actually tell it to? And then the whole back half of it is really structured around who do you tell it to and how do people respond, and the whole healing journey process for myself.
Thank you.
This is
sure.
Barbara.
And like I said, if you want to hear the little 5-minute version of it, that's on the website. That gives you a tiny little taste of it.
Barbara Alaprentis here. I just want to say that I was there when you did it in 2003, and I will never forget it. It was powerful. I love humor. That's how I deal with it in my life. No matter what happens, my husband's dying, I'm making jokes. It's just the way I do it. But your humor and your use of humor in that piece, I will never forget it. And it stayed with me. So when I saw that, that's why I went to see you this, you know, in Richmond. But I can tell you, the humor, I didn't remember what, did you say that the storytellers didn't get the humor? Because I was probably
the storytellers did. I've never had a group laugh so hard.
Yeah, well, yeah, I know. And
I guess
I was,
it really is funny.
And I was one of them, and I applaud you. I just, this presentation was just wonderful. I'm still trying to keep it all in my head and go to the website in a little bit. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you, thank you.
Oh, thanks, Barbara. I really have to come back to, like, even though I'm not allowed to, like, put funny in the subtitle, I can't call it funny in any of the marketing stuff. But I use lots of quotes from people. So, like, my favorite quote that I have is somebody who said, this is my truth. I learned that there is hope and humor and healing somewhere in the hell.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, other people will speak to the humor of it in the quotes that I use.
Yeah.
But I don't specifically say anything about it being funny in my marketing material, because people tend to push back against that if I'm saying it.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes all the difference in the world. I go in, especially, like, I've gone in and done, like, mandatory programs for 250 student athletes who are just picked that they have to be there.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, oh my God, there's a survivor and we're going to get blamed and everybody thinks I'm,
oh, yeah.
It's so, you know, everybody, the same way when I would get introduced as a storyteller to junior high and they think that I'm going to be, you know, 87 in a rocking chair reading Goldilocks and the Three Bears, I get introduced as, you know, a survivor coming to talk for this, and they are all sure that I am an angry feminist, which I am, but not in the way they mean it, an angry feminist who is there to blame all the men in the world and dump all her pain on them. Mm-hmm. And so for me to be able to start in the place of the unicorn really just pulls people to like, oh, wow, this is totally not what I'm expecting. And as soon as they laugh at the unicorn piece, it's like I feel the whole room relax, and I'm really negotiating permission to go to places they weren't expecting.
Ah, that's wonderful. Excellent.
Does anybody else have a question or comment?
Well, this is just a kind of curious question. This is Joe. You mentioned that you had to work through several titles before the things fell. And I wonder if you'd share that, because I just was on the website, and the title is now The Road to Shameless, A Survivor's True Story of Rape and Recovery. What did you start out with? I mean, what was that?
I started out with Attack of the Killer What If. And at that point, I was actually pretty adamant that I didn't really want the title to give away what it was about. That was for the Fringe show. Then when I did it a few years later, I actually had done a big flip where I actually wanted the word rape in the title, because I'd come to the conclusion of, like, you know, how do you stop the action if you're not able to say the word? And we were using the title Date Rape for Beginners, which on some level still for me feels like the inner spiritual title for it. But I had to really get away from that because, people would really end up thinking that this was like going to be a how-to thing for rapists. And I had like, really? Come on. Really? Until I found out that, actually on Amazon, there are books being sold that are how-to books for how to cultivate children to be prey for sexual predators. That, like, there actually are how-to books about this out there in the mainstream. And I had to put my little high horse away. And it really became a thing of, like, what's the aspiration? What's the thing I'm really trying to do? I mean, it's about branding in a lot of ways. What is it that I'm really trying to do? So I like the title, The Road to Shameless. And I will say that, and I get to have a pretty funny, I get to have a joke in the show about, you know, it's called The Road to Shameless for a reason, in that it's being on the path. It's not called a place called Shameless. Because I'm not sure if that exists, you know? So it's not like I'm up there as the person who has put all shame away and now why don't they join me? It's like, yeah, it's a path that we're on. I'll say the subtitle changes quite a bit depending on where I am. Some places want to say sexual assault. Some people want to say rape. Some people want to say recovery. Some people want to say healing. You know, it's like, what is their particular language that they want to use for that? But I'm pretty happy with Road to Shameless at this point, and then the subtitle can shift as needed.
Love that, Road to Shameless. Wow. Well, Nancy, I also got to see when you presented your story. This is Allison.
Hey, Allison.
Hi, Allison.
And I thought it was marvelous. And I'm just so impressed with your dedication over time to the topic. It seems like it's been an uphill battle, but still worthwhile. I really learned a lot listening to all the different ways you've approached it and learned about it. And I love that you're working on prevention.
Well, I will say that, yeah, it has been an uphill battle, and quite often I end up thinking, why do I keep trying to do this? But on another level, when I really started going out to college campuses, like back in 2010, 2011, and I started getting out there, I had on some deep level of realization that 50 years of life, I was 50 in 2010, that all of my years as a storyteller and all of my years as a survivor had really sort of, I think of them as the twined roots of the work that I'm doing, and that they really, that I've been pointed towards this for a very long time. And I can still have the feelings of I don't know enough, or I don't know how to market, or there's so many more people who are more experienced than I am, or all that. But the thing that I really bring is an understanding of story, which just very few people in this field of prevention work have. And to be able, and that's not just about how I tell my story, that's how also about how I listen to other people's stories. And
can you say more about how you listen to other people's stories? It's Laura. Hi.
Hi. Like I said, that I feel like this has really deepened my work as a storyteller. It's also really deepened my work as a story coach. Mm-hmm. I really end up listening for the things that are underneath what people are talking about. And I end up, I think somehow because I end up listening to the story, if this makes sense at all, I don't know if I'm going to say this very well. When I'm working with somebody as a story coach and they bring me a really hard story, I always have to do a therapist disclaimer that I'm not a therapist. I'm not trying to be a therapist. I'm not trying to heal them or cure them of anything. But in order to make something art, you actually have to figure out a whole lot of stuff about how that story impacts you and where it fits in your life before you're going to be able to do successful art. So my goal is around helping people make good art. But to do that, they have to work out a fair amount of stuff emotionally to be able to make the good art. So we have to do that. And I think when, like, after doing this program, when I'm listening to people, there's a way in which I'm listening in the same way. It's not like somebody comes to me and says, help me make this into art. But, you know, I'm thinking of a student who came to me and was talking about having a little sister in her fraternity that she had something really bad happen to her and trying to get her little sister to go to counseling, you know, and she can't get her little sister to do that. And I have a lot of people who will come up and tell me about something bad that's happened to somebody else and how they're trying to get that person to go to help.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask questions of them pretty much the same way that I ask questions of people telling me stories to work on stories. Mm-hmm. That I'm really aware that people usually start at a place that is at the absolute outskirts of what they really want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask questions, and I ask them in a really non-judgmental way, and I just listen. And even though I have a personality that would really like to fix and fix right away, again, my work as a story coach and my work doing this has given me a lot of patience to just listen. And I'm not saying that therapists can't do that. Like, therapists and counselors can do that really well. But for a lot of these people, they're not getting to those people without going through someone that they perceive as a survivor first. And so I can really listen to try to get at what's going on underneath. And then instead of telling them what to do, often I may take a piece of my experience or a piece of my story, something that wasn't in the show, because, you know, 98% of it isn't in the show, and sort of hold up a little mirror of, well, here's how I struggled with that. Here's how I, you know, here's the path that I was on with that. And that I,
hello,
and maybe talk about here's the way I finally found my way through that, or here's where I'm still trying to find my way through that, so that I can just be with them in it. And on some level, it's a protector to me that I'm listening to it as a story, and I know it's their experience. I know they're in pain. People could be crying. You know, it's not that I'm not empathetic. I am really empathetic. But if I'm listening as a story, I'm hearing on a level where I'm not just knee-jerk responding somebody's crying, I need to stop them crying. I need to make them feel better. Mm-hmm. I know there's some nugget underneath wherever they started that they're trying to get to. And I can listen us to that place. And sometimes I have stayed with somebody for 3 hours after a program till we get to that place. So I don't know if that
is different for every person, or is that a place we all need to get to in order to heal from difficult events? What do you think?
Oh, I think, I think the answer is yes and yes. I think there is some essential thing on the inside about self-forgiveness and about acceptance that, and not trying to change the past and learning that we can't control the things that happen to us, but we get to control the story that we tell about them and the story we live from them. So on one level, I think there is a baseline of some commonality. But with the individuals that I'm talking to, they're in really different places with that. So with a lot of people, it's just something really specific. You know, I want to tell my mom, but I don't think my mom could handle it. But I really like to tell her, but I think she'll fall apart. And, you know, somebody who's just really struggling with telling a particular person, or somebody who's really struggling with going to the police, or somebody who's really struggling with, and I want to make it really clear, I spend a tremendous amount of time like, and you have resources on this campus, and here, let me, you know, like, I'm not just like, I'm going to solve this. I'm very aware. I'm leaving. So my goal in almost every case is to get them comfortable enough and dug into another layer of what they're getting at enough that they can see the value of talking to somebody, so I can get them to go talk to somebody who's a professional. I'm always trying to plug them in to somebody else. But if I just do that at the beginning of the conversation, most of them won't go. If we actually get to spend a little time and just get one layer down on whatever particular thing they're bringing, then from that one layer down, there's more chance that they'll go to somebody. I have no statistics to back that up. That's just a feeling.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Nancy. This has been an amazing hour.
Yes.
Thank you for
and I think
whether
or not, you know, we're involved in that exact work, there's great insight there for the way we connect with listeners, the importance of that relationship, our responsibility to the people we tell stories to and listen to stories from. So I thank you again for your time this evening. Does anybody have any other final burning questions?
I just wanted to say that it's just once again what we learned in Storytelling 101, when you mentioned, Nancy, that you changed and you have to know where you're going, know your audience and be ready to, you know, plug into what you need to do. It's important. It's about knowing the audience. And I really I responded to what you said about that. And there's just one other thought that's just running through my mind. I have a daughter-in-law who's a lawyer, and she was working the state of Massachusetts. I'm just wondering about the police departments and the lawyers. Her job was a special unit in the DAs through Massachusetts about going and training the police department and the district attorneys on how to interrogate and how to prosecute these cases and how to talk to the victims and that kind of thing. And it kept running through my mind. I wonder if people like these DAs and the police, she'd go into rooms with the rookies and tell them how they would have to treat the families and what to say and how to interrogate. I don't know what this means. I'm just throwing it out there.
No, that's a realm I would like to get into at some point because
that's what I thought.
That's a realm I'd like to get into. I had the experience at one point where I was doing research before I went to one college, and I ended up talking to like the police captain who was in charge of whatever their sexual violence unit was. It's called different places. And he was answering some questions, and he was great, and he was talking about the training they had, and I was like, oh, great, I'm so glad there are people like this here. And we were talking about a particular very high-visibility case that was going on, so he couldn't give me a lot of details, but it was something that had involved a student and student-athletes, and it had taken place in one of the dorms that a lot of athletes lived in. And there was a point at which his voice just dropped in that little I'm going to tell you a secret way, and it said, you know, he said, you know, she was warned not to go in that building. And I'm thinking, oh, no. You know, like, you're the captain of the squad. And this is what I mean by modeling lack of shame. Instead of saying, and, like, meeting people where they are, what I really wanted to say is, what did you just say to me? But I didn't, because that wouldn't be very helpful. And I said, oh, really? You know, I was warned about Eddie. Everybody warned me about him. And it just stopped him dead. He was like, really? And I said, sure. You know, I mean, nobody said he was a rapist, but they all said, oh, fast Eddie. And people said stuff about me that wasn't true. What am I going to listen to, a rumor? Plus, you're 19. It just, you know, and I'm supposed to understand that there's a building on campus that's so dangerous that if you go in there, you will be raped and you have to know not to go in. You know, and I just took the whole thing and turned it around. But a lot of it had to do with having to not be ashamed myself about the fact that I'd been warned. And to be able to just take that out and say that, to deconstruct the shame and the victim blaming that we have around it. But it certainly upped my gumption for wanting to get in and work with those kinds of groups, too.
Wow.
Thank you.
Well,
thank you.
If anybody ends up with other questions or anything, you can always email me. There's a way through on my website or, you know.
There's ways that the healing
That's very generous of you. Thank you, Nancy.
This.
And everybody can remind everybody that you can, you know, email, Twitter, whatever you do, put it on your Facebook page to let people know that this teleconference will be up on the HSA website in fairly short order. How long do we think that'll take, Joe?
Usually it takes 2 days, I think, we'll try to do a little summary of just what people might expect and some of the links, certainly back to Nancy's website, and also to The Art of Hosting, which is a very interesting methodology, and, you know, if we had another hour, we could probably go into that, and
maybe we should invite someone to talk about that.
Yeah, I think of that, too.
Mary Alice Arthur. You should have Mary Alice Arthur.
There you go. Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you, everybody. Thank you, Joe.
Thanks,
thank you, Alice.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you for taking the time to be on the call.
Oh. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Okay.